Today on the Monocle Weekly, Edition 74, we're in crisp autumnal Stockholm, where we'll be checking on the state of Brand Sweden.
We have an awareness problem, since we have to deal today with so many new countries and regions and people that don't know anything about us compared to our traditional partners.
That was Thomas Carlhead, director at the Swedish Institute. And forget about cars and pop stars, we'll also be getting a read on why the Swedish thriller has become the country's biggest global export.
In France, I think they've always been a bit jealous of Sweden because we have the Nobel Prize and we always think so highly of ourselves. And now when they see Stieg Larsson's novel, they see this country that has fallen apart and they love it.
That was author and broadcaster Daniel Hallin. And later in the program, we'll be hearing from Hannes Huggeman, co-owner of the Malmö-based shop Trebien, who've just launched a new venture here in Stockholm called Welcome.
The high street chains can't keep up because the customer values quality and craftsmanship a lot, and it's impossible for the high street chains to do that.
And now from Stockholm, the Monocle Weekly with Tyler Brulé, Andrew Tuck and Robert Bound.
Hello, it's Sunday, October 10th, 2010, and you're with the Monocle Weekly here in Stockholm. I'm Tyler Brulé, along with my regular sidekicks, Andrew Tuck and Robert Bound. And also new sidekick, Elna Nikkanen Anderson, our Nordics correspondent. We were just in lovely Helsinki together.
Yes, we had a great time in Helsinki.
We did. We'll talk about our dinners at Seahorse in a moment. Welcome, Andrew.
Well, thank you very much for having me again. Nice to be in the Nordic land.
Welcome, Rob.
It is. It's nice to be here. It's the season of Mr. Mellow Fruitfulness. We were just talking about how nice an autumnal it is up here compared to London, actually.
It is. They're a good, 5 weeks ahead here, probably?
Yeah.
In general.
Yeah.
About
a yellow,
going on.
Reds.
I also, which means, of course, that fashion's also 5 weeks ahead as well. Didn't you notice that on the streets today?
I've seen some red cords.
Did you?
Yeah.
Yeah. I saw some red trousers today.
They're quite a Swedish thing, aren't
it? It seems that as we've been running around town that we've all seen the same people as well. It's sort of like a very small cast of extras in a film.
Exactly.
Okay, costume change.
Yeah. Well, that one die in a Western? Why'd they come back to life? Yeah.
When we arrived, we got out of the cab and within 30 seconds we met somebody who's an old friend of Monocle. So it was like, hey, hello. It's good. We like it.
I've got some treats as well. As it's Sunday morning, wouldn't be a Sunday morning show out of the Nordic world if we didn't have a bag of bulle. So I was, on the way I stopped at Pressbyrån, and this is, anyway, I'll just pass them around. There's a canel bulle for you.
Thank you.
And Rob, you can just pass that along to Andrew.
Lovely. I'll need to show you the great bakeries.
But don't get any of the, I know, there are better bakeries in the world than Bosse at Pressbyrån putting them in the special oven. Anyway, that's a bit of sound effects, but I was very excited because we're in the studios. In fact, we're in the hockey studio of Sveriges Radio, and there's this extraordinary control panel in front of me. It's quite a nice studio, though, isn't it?
It's amazing. It's something like, you should be at the UN or something. It feels very kind of imposing. We've got a huge table.
Yeah, I said we should be signing an environmental accord because it's very Swedish, this table. It's very sort of organic, ergonomically shaped.
And you have a lot of knobs in front of you.
I don't have just knobs. I've got a whole keyboard. I've got 15 jingles in front of me.
None of which work.
No, none of which work. Sounds like I'm actually sort of doing like rapid addition, if you can hear it. but beforehand, we did have a preview, but for copyright reasons, we can't play any of the jingles. But I like the He Shoots, He Scores one the best.
That's nice. You've got a lot of knobs. I've got blonde wood. What? I'm just keeping it Swedish.
Absolutely. Okay, and you've got a little felty pad in front of you as well.
Just in case.
For a hockey studio, for a very butch hockey studio, nice Marimekko curtains.
Yes,
exactly.
Yeah, there.
Yeah. I think they did that for you. I think that's for you. Elna, Stockholm versus Helsinki. I mean, we were just in Helsinki. We were working on our upcoming Finnish survey or survey of Finland. Obviously, Nikkanen is a rather Finnish sounding name. You grew up in Finland. Tell us the difference. I mean, from your view, from your, of course, completely unbiased view.
Stockholm
versus Helsinki. Yeah.
Yeah. Difference. Helsinki is completely, has its own character. I mean, Stockholm is international and it's kind of trendy. And Helsinki has its own style, and it's sort of a mixture of that Russian influence and the Swedish influence and a little bit of that European. And
don't forget the Finnish influence as well, though.
Yeah, of course. But the Finns are a sort of mixture of that in a sense.
But I don't know, I felt it, and I don't want to give everything away that we're doing in the survey, but I feel there's sort of a certain sense of confidence in Finland at the moment. Now, you really feel that probably over the last sort of 4 or 5 years that, that Finland is really moving on. I mean, in one part, you know, you've got, well, you certainly have sitting in Stockholm, or if you're sitting in Denmark or Norway, you know, SAS, an airline which is very much in crisis at the moment. Then you've got Finnair, which, you know, just continues to expand into Asia, an incredible hub. But there's also just, a confidence and dynamism that you feel. And you're right, on the street here, of course, everyone looks fantastic and there is this sort of cosmopolitan edge. But I don't know, I think there's something definitely happening in Finland.
Yes, I've been very glad to see this because the Finns have been sort of suffering from an inferiority complex for some years. And just the past 10 years with the EU membership and the EMU and everything, we sort of become much more confident and international. And now you just see this great enthusiasm in every area from design to entrepreneurship and innovations. Mm. Yeah, it's great.
As we mentioned at the top of the program, we're going to be talking about branding today. Andrew, if I say to you sort of brand Sweden, what do you think about what comes to mind?
It's design legacy, obviously, telecommunications. So it still feels that, you know, a reasonably high-tech nation. I think it's a nation that you do associate with kind of with youth, with good fashion brands, with, you know, obviously with H&M. It seems to be a brand that's good on the high street, good at some elements of diplomacy. But yeah. I think it's an interesting brand, but, you know, maybe like lots of these Nordic brands, many of the things that you reference, actually with lots of national brands, are a little bit outdated. So like everywhere, it's always good to have a brush up.
Rob, what about you?
Not just Blondwood.
No, not just Blondwood.
So much more.
Well, I think of Sweden so much more than Blondwood.
So much more than Blondwood. Oh, I always think of it in terms of you know, the amazing music that comes out of Sweden and its phenomenal influence on all the big acts in the American charts and their sort of prodigious influence in Asia as well in that kind of music. The sort of dream dust that they seem to sprinkle on all over all sorts of pop music, you know, the big hits and the big stars. What are you laughing at?
I was worried someone's going to ask me a question because I realised
you've got a mouthful of bull. You managed it on purpose, didn't you?
There's rarely a great pop song that doesn't seem to have a Scandinavian name in the publishing rights to it.
So you really think of music,
Archipelago, and the beauty of that. I think that's a really sort of exportable Swedish thing.
And what's interesting is that neither of you mentioned cars.
Mm. Well, it's a shame. Well,
you mentioned sort of Bomber, but neither of you mentioned IKEA, which I think is interesting as well.
But then I guess with the car debate is quite interesting is, you know, that it shouldn't be just that your shareholders are set outside your country. But for many people now, Volvo doesn't seem to be a very particularly Swedish brand.
No.
So that's, and you know, no matter how much people may pretend otherwise, it just doesn't feel a very Swedish brand anymore. So that I don't know how much that carries forth the kind of nation's soft power.
Ellen, I'm not sure if it's fair to ask you the question then when you think of brand Sweden. And excuse me while I eat my canelbulle, but... As a Finn who's, you know, been transplanted here, when you think of the country and the brand, what stands out?
Well, the things I mentioned before, of course, the sort of sense for trends and all of the stuff that you mentioned. But I was also thinking of this dark seriousness that's in the literature and in film, Bergman and Strindberg and these guys. It's a very Swedish thing.
Mm. Well, for a homegrown spin on the state of brand Sweden, we're also joined by Thomas Carlhead. He's the director at the Swedish Institute here in Stockholm, and he has the task of selling brand Sweden to the rest of the world. He joins us here in studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
What's it like selling brand Sweden to the rest of the world? Is it an easy sell?
It's quite an easy sell still.
When you go to market, what is in your bag of tricks?
Actually, if you compare it to the brand, it has a lot of strength compared to many other countries. You should remember that Sweden is quite a small country globally, and we have a stronger voice than we really should have if you compare with other countries with populations below, with less than 10 million people. I think the strength that we have is very much found when we measure around what we call the brand hexagon when it comes to governance and culture and export. It's a fairly well-balanced basket. When it comes to the strongest areas, governance and the kind of values that Sweden and the Swedish society stands for.
So issues of transparency, equality, all of these
tolerance,
things.
Tolerance, equality, global development issues like that. But also when it comes to businesses, we have a lot of strong international brands, as you all know, Volvo, Saab, H&M and so on. And also when it comes to the two weakest points is actually, even though we hit top 15 in those fields, is tourism and culture.
Mm.
And in culture, it's I think the more contemporary culture and creative industries are the strong selling points, even though more traditional culture and cultural heritage is a weaker point.
But it's funny that you say that, because leading into it, as we asked Rob and said, you know, what sort of strikes you when you think of Brand Sweden, and immediately, and it's not just, or is it only because you only know culture, Rob? Maybe that's it. But you talked about, but you know, you, when you were saying music earlier, though, no,
it's I think that's a sort of, you know, we talk about soft power often. Yeah. It seems like a big soft power sell. Sweden seems to, you know, some
industrial brands or strong business brands, and you mentioned sort of H&M, Saab, and Volvo. I would sort of argue, yes, H&M, strong brand. You know, Volvo and Saab have had some very high profile issues, and I'm wondering, yes, they're still around, so maybe they're powerful, but you know, Volvo been sold to the Chinese, I guess, rather successfully. You know, Saab sold to another conglomerate, and we'll see what happens there. Has that also been an issue though? Because you know, for such a solid country, you know, it was big news. You know, front of the Wall Street Journal, lead story sort of on Bloomberg all the time. What was going to happen with these companies? So was that a tricky time also for Brand Sweden when there so much indecision about what would happen to businesses that were really the cornerstone of Sweden Incorporated?
I think it's a good reflection of what's going on right now with globalization. And actually, Volvo was sold maybe 15 years ago to an American company, and we had the same kind of discussion at that time. But the brand remains Swedish still. And I think when you hear the Chinese company, Geely, speaking about it, they're going to remain it as a very strong brand for its own. Mm. And all the kind of values and connotation that Volvo has is very much closely related to Sweden and Swedishness.
I know my jury's still out on what the Chinese will do with it and how much it will remain a Swedish brand. But, you know, I guess that remains to be seen. Andrew, I mean, when you think about it, you know, you were talking sort of, you know, earlier about, I guess, in many ways, when you look at what this country stands for and its, you know, great sort of, you know, social democracy and all the values that go with it. Is there a side, though, as well? And, you know, we were having a discussion with some of the Swedish editors that as Swedes have sort of ventured out into the world, too, that there's a sense that in a globalized world, we have to be incredibly competitive. If you've also had a little bit too much of a state which has looked after you too much, you almost become a little bit too comfortable as well. And I'm wondering do you think that's also an issue for Brand Sweden?
Yeah, we were discussing with Anna, weren't we, this question of, you know, that in Sweden, if their child's sick, they stay at home, and there's even a verb for, Elna, you can give me the verb, which is to...
Baba.
to stay at home with your child for the day because your kid's sick, whereas in other industrialised nations, you'd be expected to be at work and you'd be expected to find your parents to come around or, you know, a babysitter to come and take care of the kid. And that kind of welfare world has kind of, in some senses, left Swedes a little bit kind of soft on the work front.
I think that coin has two sides. You can speak about incentives to be very striving for in your work and so on. But it, on the other hand, if we look on the value chart for a World Value Survey, for instance, as collective, I mean, the mindsets of Swedes are very much they are collective people, consensus driven. But at the same time, we are the most individualistic country in the world. And how does that go together? I mean, the good side of having a generous welfare state that looks after you is that you're not driven by fear. We make a very strong connection between being progressive, new thinking, open and caring. Because to be able to be innovative, you need to be open. To be able to be open, you have to live in a caring environment that is allowed to be open and new thinking.
Are you finding this is a debate that you're having to update, though? Because, you know, for example, in the recent elections, we've seen this kind of shift to the right wing. Within Sweden, there is a lot of debate over taxation and about, you know, what should be done with you know, in the social world and what should be people should start paying for. So is it a bit of a kind of an old image of, you know, that everybody is equal and cared for here? And the fact that, as we've seen with the election, actually some people aren't that keen on everybody having the same rights, and actually some people do want to see an end to immigration.
The Swedish model or the Swedish welfare state has had moderate changes during the last year. I think there's the social contract between the Swedish citizens and the Swedish government is still very much the same. There's a very broad consensus that is the Swedish way of life and the way people really would like to keep it that way. When it comes to the election, when it comes to immigration, it's that kind of shifts in values and responses is going in probably in waves. We had the same kind of election results 15 years ago when we have the New Democracy voted into the Swedish parliament. Considering that, it's still quite open and tolerant country. Mm. If, I mean, we're working in a European context, and we can see the waves of what's happening is in the European context, it was probable to hit us as well in the end.
Elna, do you think that, as you know, someone who of course grew up in Finland, but that also has been here for, you know, for some time now as well, that this is sustainable? I mean, in a world which becomes more globalized, and, you know, really, of course, as Thomas was saying, you know, there is this social contract, but do you think that it has to be rewritten further than where it is at the moment? Because if this country is going to compete against the likes of China's and maybe sort of, you know, smaller, you know, more agile places like Singapore, for example, yeah, does that contract need to be rewritten somehow?
Generally, I think these systems of welfare are good because, as you say, people are not driven by fear, and it might also actually be a good thing that you know that your family is in good hands, even though you're at work and so on. But then, of course, there's also the backside of maybe those systems being exploited. So maybe it's good that we have this conservative government now, and we get a break from the long reign of the social democrats, so that we can at least look at what do we have and if it needs to be sort of redone a little bit. Because even the conservative government that we have here, the Swedish right wing, it's not very extreme compared to many many other countries. So
there was a piece that came out on Friday by the Reputation Institute, which is quite interesting. Sweden being the most respected country, followed very hotly by Canada, of course, and then Australia and Switzerland. Andrew, who do you think came at the bottom three of the world reputation list? Everyone can have a little bit of a guess.
And how long is it literally every country in the world?
I think it's pretty much every country in the world.
Zimbabwe and North Korea.
Actually, neither of them are there, Rob. Don't look at the sheet.
I'm not looking at the sheet.
You're such a cheat.
I'm not looking at the sheet. I look at you literally moving it. I can't. I would have said, well, I think there's a reason for you asking this question. I expect the US is probably on there for some reason.
Norway is not on it.
Norway.
US, no. They're not there.
Pyongyang.
One begins with an I.
Iran.
Yeah.
And Afghanistan.
No.
What was the list? Demo.
So this is just
the worst reputation.
Yeah, worst reputation. Countries with the worst reputation.
Eritrea.
No. We've got Colombia, but interestingly, we also got China as well at the bottom of the list.
Colombia at the bottom.
One of the bottom three: Iran, Colombia, and China, at bottom of the list. Which is, I mean, interesting, you know, and we can sort of, you know, go into the metrics behind all of it. But, you know, the country has a good reputation. I like the country. I admire and respect the country. I trust the country. You know, which is, so when you sort of talk about, Thomas, when you're going out and selling it, I mean, all of those points, you know, are incredibly important. I'm wondering, when you look at something like the Reputation Institute and their reports, I mean, obviously, if you're a country at the bottom of the list, I mean, we see lots of corporations, you know, other manufacturers wanting to go and learn from Toyota. Do you think we have a case here, or is it currently the case that other countries, actually other governments, want to come and spend time?
Definitely. We have lots of different representatives from different states visiting us. And actually, you mentioned Colombia, and I've been working with the Minister of Foreign Affairs in Colombia for some time as well, just to how they are working with their image, which is really affected by the kind of history they have had for the last 20 years.
I guess, and I mean, Andrew, you were slightly surprised when you said, you know, that Colombia is on the list, because in many ways, we also know a lot of the good things that are happening in the country, but are, of course, overshadowed by, in some things that are potentially beyond the government's control as well.
Yeah, it's amazing. You know, Colombia is suffering from the fact that, you know, that lots of people want to buy drugs that are grown there, and it's not particularly Colombians' fault always, you know, that they have a bad reputation. It's the reputations of people in Western Europe who want to buy cocaine or in America that, you know, force these problems on Colombia. Just one little tiny question we picked up earlier in the show with one of the other guests, which is, I was just interested, you know, when you're pitching yourself out there, pitching Sweden, you're in a kind of competitive market up here in the north of Europe with, you know, your neighbours. Are you trying to make clear what makes you not Finnish and what makes you not Norwegian and what makes you not Danish? Because you're trying to attract businesses in here. Yeah, and we see all these countries as well spending quite a lot of money on their brand images at the moment. Is there a bit of jostling when you go out there? How do you kind of politely point out that you're different?
To be honest, we don't really think that way, to distinct ourselves from our neighbors. We're very much alike. We have the same value base to a very high degree. And when we look at our different strategies, they look very much the same. The thing being the biggest country in Scandinavia helps us a lot. So even when Norway do something good, or does something good, or Denmark or Finland, it's always spills over a bit to Sweden. As long as if the Scandinavian brand is good, is strong, it's going to be spilling over on the Swedish brand, because that's the strongest brand among the the four different brands.
Elna, one thing that we were hearing a lot about when we were in Helsinki working and talking about sort of all things that are happening there, that there's this big brand audit going on in Finland at the moment. And what's interesting is that they really want to use this as a rallying cry for the whole country. So maybe we know something that you don't, I don't know, but it does seem a little bit kind of gloves off in their positioning, because one of the elements that they talked about is that a sort of a stoic can-doism in Finland. And maybe that's also vis-a-vis their neighbors in Russia as well. But one thing that came up, which I was very interesting, which I heard more than once over the last few weeks, that, in Finland, okay, of course, Finland very different than Russia, but they said they had the same hot summer. They have many of the same, of course, topographical conditions as Russia did. But they said those fires wouldn't happen in Finland. Even if they did start, they said Finns would just sort of rally together and they would sort it out. Without fire trucks, they'd pee on it. They would do whatever they could. But they, the Finns would just sort it out. But they were talking about sort of a new brand proposition for the country, which is interesting, saying that if someone had a heart attack on the plane, you wouldn't say, is there a doctor on board? Is there a Finn on board?
That's a good brand proposition.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? But also that they want to be very explicit with it, to the public. And I guess going back to our earlier question, whether, as you said, social policy has changed here slightly. How does that sort of, buy-in, happen? And do you think that almost there needs to be a new script for Swedes potentially? Or do they just sort of carry on, singing from the same hymn sheet?
I think not really a new script. I mean, values changes in such a long time, long waves. So it's basically it's the same. Mm. The thing is, the challenges that we have in the time we live right now, except for having a very good reputation and a great goodwill around the world, we have an awareness problem. Since we have to deal today with so many new countries and regions and people that don't know anything about us compared to our traditional partners and cooperation countries. The level of awareness is really low in India, Indonesia, and so on. So that's one problem. And the other one is to update the image, because people's images and position, where they position a country or what else, tends to be bound to generations. And that goes to the Swedish model as well. We often speak about it when it comes to the American context, because they still call Sweden socialist in many, many different occasions on TV, not least after the election with Barack Obama, and should United States become Sweden. And the thing with the social contract and the Swedish model is it looks quite differently today. Sweden is one of the most regulated countries in the world, with free market solutions in almost every area, not least in areas that would be impossible for other countries, like in the state pensions, electricity markets, and so on. So, I mean, the Swedish society looks very much differently, the Swedish model, but still the basic social contract looks the same.
Are the off-licenses still state-run?
Sorry?
Are the off-licenses?
The liquor stores.
The liquor stores.
Yeah, but that's maybe the last.
That's the next.
That's what I don't like.
Exactly. Good curveball. Thomas Carlhead from the Swedish Institute, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly, back after this. Back with the Monocle Weekly here in Stockholm. The last few years have seen a crime wave sweep across Sweden, at least as far as its publishing industry is concerned. The popularity of Swedish crime thrillers abroad has led to a host of unknown authors becoming household names internationally, and with lucrative film and TV deals up for grabs, more authors are clamoring to be the next Stieg Larsson. So why has this new genre become such a success, and is it sustainable long term? Daniel Hulin, award-winning author and presenter of the literary TV program Babel on Swedish state network SVT, joins us here to discuss it.
Thank you.
I want to know, so if we drove out into the Swedish countryside, the crime-infested Swedish countryside. Hmm. Would we see lots of writing schools right now? So what was sort of formal, sort of agriculture land is just barns full of children learning how to write crime thrillers.
Perhaps you shouldn't go to a writing school in Sweden, because they have a lot more pretension. You go to a Swedish writing school to write novels that are not crime novels, so to speak, more of art novels. You should probably go to JMK here, who educates journalists, because most Swedish crime novels authors are journalists from the start. And of course, that has to do with that the crime novel tends to need a lot of research, and journalists are, of course, that's their main thing, to do research.
So if we really sort of dove into the back covers of most of most of the people who become sort of, you know, major household names, we'd probably see that they had somewhere had a pass with Aftonbladet or Expressen.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, I think it's true. Or you could also try to study law. Some lawyers have made it as well, because they're well close to the crime scenes, of course. If you want to make a huge success, you should try to be a communist.
Explain.
The biggest names. You could say that you have to make it in Sweden to start with. At least up to now, you had to make it in Sweden first. But now I think that I see a paradigm here. I see a shift. Maybe we could get back to that. But it all started with Maja Sjöwall and Per Wahlöö in the 70s, who were Marxist writers who wanted to criticize the social democratic society from a left point of view. Mm. And by writing novels that reached out to a broader mass, and then they used the crime novel as a form for that. And after them, we had Jan Guillou and Henning Mankell and Stieg Larsson, who was also on the left side of... some of them were members of the Communist Party, and Stieg Larsson was even more on the left side. And there's been this general interest, I think, among Swedish writers for these matters. We have a very strong proletarian literature in the bottom of it all. So maybe you could say that you should try to join a communist party in order to at least to make it in Sweden and criticize the social democratic country from a left point of view.
I mean, I've never read any of Henning Mankell's books. I have plenty of them, always with the best intentions. You know, I'm picking them up, you know, as we're sort of heading off on holiday, but I've never really jumped into one. And I've only watched Wallander, both in Swedish and the Kenneth Branagh version on BBC Four. But I mean, would you say there is a lot of social commentary?
Yeah, a lot. That's Henning Mankell's thing is to be to comment a social society and commented the fall of the welfare society, so to speak. That's his main thing and his unique selling point from the start, I think. But then there's a second question, how to reach outside the country. And if you look, like, for instance, I'm generalizing now, of course, in Germany compared to France, Germans, of course, they come here every summer. They are the largest group of tourists coming to Sweden, and they buy red cottage houses in the countryside. And they like the Swedish nature. So all the covers you see of Swedish crime novels published in Germany at one point were on the cover there was this red cottage, no matter what kind of novel you've written. For instance, John Ivy Lindquist, who wrote a very great vampire story that's set in present time in a suburb of Stockholm, even that, when it was published in Germany, it was a red cottage on the outside. In France, however, I think they've always been a bit jealous of Sweden, because we have the Nobel Prize and we always think so highly of ourselves. You know, Sweden's mission in the UN in the 60s and 70s with Olof Palme and all this world, to be the world's conscious, and so to speak, and have this country as a role model. And now when they see Stieg Larsson's novel, they see this country that has fallen apart, and they love it.
Rob, doesn't it strike you as rather odd when you think about how these covers are being marketed in Germany, that you know, Birgit and Helmut, they go and buy their nice little red cottage in Småland, and then you know, Bossa and Lena are going to hack their heads off next door?
Yeah, exactly. It's sort of something that you probably wouldn't see on the estate agent's details. Yeah, but it's nice that your house comes with a free axe murderer.
It's important to make Bosse an alcoholic or someone who has fallen between the chairs and social welfare.
What would Lena's problem be, do you think?
Maybe she's trying to get pregnant or something. Or maybe she's just being beaten by Bosse and... there's a revenge motive there.
I wanted to know about that, because there is such a darkness to Swedish and then broadly Scandinavian crime fiction. Like American crime fiction is noir, and it's a kind of genre within a genre. British crime fiction is very kind of, it's sort of cozy murder. Nice cozy murder. Yeah, people sit down on a Sunday evening and watch a nice cozy murder. And but Sweden's very dark. Where do you think that comes from?
Well, it's a dark country, of
course. It's getting darker in general.
To start, we don't have these country houses like you have in Britain, for instance. There are red cottages, nothing more like that. The genre issue is maybe because the American novelists they like much more big stories, and they like literature for itself to some extent. But Swedes, they just like to see other people's misery to some extent. It's very important for Swedes to compare themselves to other and look how poor it is. I think maybe. Daniel, I wanted to just ask one quick question, which is, does this feed through into good readership figures within Sweden? Do Swedes read a lot more books than they used to? Because if you have all this amazing literature which is coming out, which is actually quite mainstream, and it's not, as you say, it's not kind of, you know, from art school writers, does that mean that you see good book sales here? Do you find young people actually reading books rather than just kind of looking at the web?
Well, it's always this question. They always say that, well, young people read much less than they used to before. But I think that's true. I think that especially these crime novelists, they reach out to all, practically. And it's a good thing. I don't think any big difference to any extent. There's always these, Nintendo games and stuff like that. But perhaps there could be a discussion when it comes to male and or female readers, because they, to some extent, if you make it to male readers, then you're really up for a bestseller. And the most recent example of this is a guy called Jonas Jonasson, who wrote this typical novel that seemed to be appealing to men to some extent. It's a kind of a mixture of history and a rather a funny little story about something. And it's very, there are a lot of facts in it to some extent. And the next generation now is Jan Valentin, who is the latest of these bestsellers, who is not a crime novelist, but he tries to be a new Dan Brown. It's more of a Tintin for grown-ups. And that may be the next thing for Swedish novelists, and those are novels who will, well, I would say that men prefer them instead of doing something else.
I wonder, is there also a certain level of fantasy, because you talk about sort of, you know, social commentary in them as well. So, you know, to appeal to men, I mean, are we seeing sort of a reversal of tables that men start to run the households in this country again?
Yeah, I am a man. I do run the household.
That's a thing.
I thought I'd just stir things up this morning.
If you want to reach out to men, there's also the main ingredients is to involve Nazis in it, because men like to read magazines. Well, you know about the Nazis experiments and all the sticky things about them. So we'll see a lot more Nazi novels in Sweden, I think, to appeal to the men who subscribe on newspapers with a lot of popular science in it.
Right.
Yeah.
Elna, this picks up on what we were talking about at dinner early in the week at Seahorse, because we were in Finland, and we said, you know, talking about, you know, what's sort of coming up in Finnish cinema. And I read a piece that, you know, one of the big films, supposedly one of the biggest budget films coming out in Finland, is about Nazi mutants from the moon. And it's
Invasion of the Space Nazis, wasn't it?
Yeah, something about space, Invasion of the Space Nazis. And of course, it was like a capsule of, like, you know, Nazi embryos on the moon. And then, of course, they come hurtling back to Earth. Look out, Rob.
Why have one show when you could have three just in one time?
Rolled into one. Yeah. I want to go back, though. I mean, you know, listening to this, do the neighbors, and whether we're sort of looking at Norway, Denmark, or Finland, are people sort of looking on at this country in envy, saying, you know, why can't we have a big pop culture export like this?
I'm sure the Finns are, yes.
Conspiring and working on something? Well, they're working on not space Nazis, obviously. But
yeah, there are a lot of crime writers in Finland as well who haven't reached out in the same way as the Swedes have. But the Swedes have always been good at marketing. And then when something sort of gets off, then it feeds itself. And now these books are sold to big movies already before they've come out. And actually this summer, because I wrote about this in a Monocle's webpage, a talent agent from Hollywood emailed me asking, do you have any tips for me? Who are the next big Swedes? And I said, look to Finland. All the Swedes are already booked. This virgin country there, you know.
Yeah, but 10 years ago, for instance, there were hardly any literary agents in Sweden. This is a big boom when it comes to marketing and so on. The Swedish publishing companies know now exactly
they
how
have
to do it.
They have in the front door of ICA when you go in, don't they?
How much of a crossover is there between the Nordic markets? So if somebody tends to make it big in Sweden, is there normally a knock-on that they're successful in Norway and they're successful in Finland? Or are they still quite national, the kind of markets up here?
When it comes to average novels, so to speak, if you make it as an average, if you're not a crime novelist, then the general route you have is throughout the Scandinavia to start with, and then maybe Germany and so on, maybe Italy. It depends on who's reading it.
Swedes will read a good Finnish novel in translation. They'll read a good novel that's come from Norway.
Norway, Norway, no.
No.
No, not in Finland either. Only if it's in Swedish.
You say these are novels that hardly reach out to any readers in, for instance, Norway, and then they translate it into Swedish and they hardly reach out to anyone there as well. But they tend to get a lot of good criticism and so on. You know, this flood with the scholarships and so on. They try to evolve this a bit more. But Swedes tend to read... don't have any idea about Norwegian writers or Danish writers as much as Norwegian writers tend to look upon Swedes. Mm. There's always been this kind of a cultural imperialism or something. But on the other hand, there's much more interesting, I think, authorships going on in Norway and in to some extent Denmark and maybe Finland than in Sweden.
And other genres as well?
Oh, I don't know, specifically other genres. Of course, Norway is the best country to live in as a writer because they have their own money. So it's very easy to get great scholarships and to get a lot of support. And Sweden has actually become a country where Norwegian writers go to live because it's so cheap for them here. Mm. Just like Swedish writers in the 50s went to France, you can live on nothing for a few years. And so that's the situation. You have a lot of Norwegian writers living here to live the classical life of a writer going on. And get drunk and write essays and so on without working.
I love the idea that Sweden's the cheap nation of Europe.
Yeah, yeah, that's right, isn't it? I'm sure they like that reputation. Daniel, just before I go, are you working on a book at the moment?
I'm thinking of trying to start.
Thinking of trying.
Yeah. I quit writing a few years ago when I had my first and second kid. But I know there's a novel for me to write, and it's about Swedish. What do you call it?
Lesbian vampires. Is this another genre fun?
No, it's.
Nazi lesbian vampires.
I have lots more pretension than so. Swedish daycare centers.
Okay.
Oh. Because there's been no novel about that's set in a daycare center, with the storytellers, of course, the protagonists. Agnes are all kids.
Of course.
And the children are committing crimes? Or?
Yeah, sooner or later. <that way. laughs>
I like it. Daniel Hillier, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly here in Stockholm. We're back after this. You're back with The Monocle Weekly here in Stockholm, where it's time for culture. With Robert Bound.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey.
Did you go down to Krukmakargatan when you were here? That's in Söder. Say that.
Krukmakargatan in Söder. Yeah.
Did you go down there?
No.
Not
yet.
I went to, you know, I think we've mentioned that shop. Well, I think we had it in the magazine Papercut.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Mm.
Which is a wonderful little outlet specializing in DVDs, must-read fiction and nonfiction, and magazines. My idea of heaven. It was great to see that they've expanded their store. So it's about 4 or 5 times the size now. Anyway, I went down, and it's great to go into an environment where you can, of course, linger, and everything is beautifully displayed by genre, which is very nice. And I sort of filled up. He actually said, he goes, do you want a bag or a box for that? Because I bought so many DVDs.
Nice. And you said, I've got the lorry part.
You know, I know we've mentioned this before, but it's so great to be in an environment where you're not sort of hassled or harried, and to go into, also to go and buy DVDs when it's not sort of Saturday evening and you don't have sort of space out, you know, in front of the shelves. But it's in a way, it's a faster process because, in fact, you know, you see a cover and then you read the back of it and you sort of go on to the next one. And I find that's actually, it's much easier than being on iTunes.
And are they doing a kind of a mixed media store, or is it just a DVD store?
No, it's. Should I repeat that, Andrew? I think all the listeners heard it. I said magazines.
But they've added a DVD store,
I've said they've expanded the store. Rob, did you get it?
I was there.
Why didn't you and I just do
the
segment
same page.
Then? And you've just been tucking into your bullet and like sort of just dipping in and out of the program. That's what's happening.
I drifted away.
I did.
What's happened to
I'm
Andrew?
Sure you were interesting once.
Rob, what do you have for us today?
We've got some Swedish music.
Good.
From the none more Swedish sounding Jenny Wilson.
Jenny Wilson.
She said Jenny Wilson. She sounds Scottish. She sounds like she couldn't sound more Scottish. Exactly. But she's actually Swedish. She's from Blekinge. Elna?
I don't know if she's from Blekinge, but sounds Swedish.
Yeah. Did I say it right?
Yes.
And this song is from an excellent
album. You had to fall off your chair there, weren't you?
I was just getting in position.
You were.
I was priming myself for
these
my delivery.
Aside from the organic table, the organic ergonomic table, these are really Starship Enterprise, these chairs.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Because they have a headrest on them.
Totally.
Sort of casing with a warp speed like this.
Exactly.
And no armrests. Compensate.
Yeah.
No, there's 2 leagues of chair. We haven't got armrests, but there's these.
Oh, actually,
you've got a headrest.
You're in
a headdress.
Oh,
I want armrests. No.
We're in business class over here.
Yeah, this is excellent.
Me and Elna in economy.
Yeah. Let's go back to Jenny Wilson.
Jenny Wilson. This is, she made an excellent album called Hardships, except it had an exclamation mark on the end of it. Hardships. And this song is called There for the Fight.
That was Jenny Wilson, or Jenny Wilson.
Maybe she changed her name because people got so fed up with seeing Swedish names in the
I like that.
It's nice, isn't it?
It's
shades away around a piano.
It has shades of, just on sort of, you know, one or two notes there, it had shades of Titio even.
It is a bit Titio. And it reminded me of Frida Hyvönen, who we did a story on as well, that kind of piano and rather lovely voice. And as you can hear from the chorus, listeners, I got the name of the song wrong. It's called Only Here for the Fight.
I know, not here. Well, Only Here for the Fight, There for the Fight. It's kind of the same thing, isn't it?
Much, yeah. I was really busy.
There should be a trick. There should be a trick in the program.
Yes, exactly. A wrong thing.
Exactly. Spot the glitch.
Spot the glitch.
There'd be
spot
many.
The glitch.
Andrew. Hello.
I'm waiting now. I'm scared of entering the fray. My God.
Did you like that?
Yeah, I did like that very much. Thank you very much.
But is the is most of it like that?
Yeah,
that kind of
does,
sort of, you know,
she does
high
sort
pitch.
Of weirdly, she does. So she rocks out a bit more, and some of it's weirdly sort of quite R&B-ish at times. But that's the more glacial Jenny.
Right. Well, wasn't that? I mean, there's a lot of, I like that sort of squeaky back, you know, sort of background singers as well.
Squeaky background singers. Jenny and the Chipmunks.
I'm here for the fight. That
bit. It's good. Don't you wish we had some jingles on this show?
I wish we had some jingles on this program, but we don't.
Yeah, see.
DR sort of sitting on them.
Yeah.
In there.
You won't switch
anyway,
them on.
Don't know if we're going to be coming back to these studios. Anyway. Did you like that, Elna?
Yes.
Do you know Jenny Wilson?
Mm.
Are you listening to any in the car?
I know of her. I haven't listened to her previously, but yeah.
Mm.
I will check her out now.
No, I liked it. Anything else for us today?
Or just
one song? It's just a one-song show.
Yeah, because I had a bit of a problem with my CD-ROM.
Your CD-ROM? Who even talks about CD-ROMs anymore?
What is that?
What is that? Ellen didn't actually mean what is that in a sort of questioning situation.
Yeah. In a question way, like, because I'm 22, I would know what that
what
is.
What even is that?
I've got news listeners. Anyway, you listen to the Monocle Weekly. This is the culture segment from Stockholm. We're back in a moment. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly. Well, on our tour of Scandinavia this week, we were pleased to discover that one of our favourite independent Swedish retailers has popped up right here in Stockholm in a special collaboration with local brand Our Legacy. Trebjen, originally from Malmö, stocks some of our favourite brands from APC to Woolrich Woolen Mills and has demonstrated that you can be a small player in a regional city, but also be a global player in e-commerce. We popped in on opening day last Friday to have a quick tour.
Hi, my name is Hannes. And I am co-founder and buyer for Trebjen Shop and our new project, the Welcome Store in Stockholm. Trebjen Shop started as a project in 2005. And me and my brother Simon, we had a shop together, and two friends, now colleagues, had another shop in a different city in Sweden. None of the shops were doing too good, so we tried to sell online together with a new name. We discovered only after like 2 weeks that online sales from Trebjen Shop was doing better than both our old stores. This shop in Stockholm differs a bit from our other shop because, first of all, it's a collaboration shop with Our Legacy, one of our first brands and oldest friends in this business. And it differs also because it's more like a free platform. It will be very versatile. It's kind of a clean space. It's designed by two friends called Arhov and Frick, and its inspiration comes from a house where we want to put, it's not too clear when you walk in that it's like that, but we have one dining room and one attic, one basement, one living room in the shop, but it's more like inspirations from a house with many different rooms, but still clean, and you get to see the product very easy. Our typical customer is a male, obviously, because we only do menswear. He's 34 to 36, the main thing is that he's very interested in clothing, but also architecture and music, maybe. He has a creative job and is prioritizing quality, but also design. So it's not only quality, it needs to be design as well. That's, I think, is typical customer for us. We have lots of future plans. We have a new web shop coming up in 3 weeks' time with a new platform. Everything is going to be all new. We have been meaning to do it for 2 years now, but now it's the time we've been working with for 5 months with this new platform. So that's the big thing for now. And then after 3 weeks, we'll see what happens.
And Hannes Hogeman, co-owner of Trebian, is here with us in the studio to tell us more. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Congratulations on the opening.
Thank you again.
It was interesting when we walked around your store. You gave us a little bit of a tour the night before that you opened, and you were unpacking the beers, and you had sort of a lot of handsome, cool guys wandering around, and what was amazing for a night before as well is that you were 100% ready to open. I guess to start, why Stockholm? And was it obvious that you had to come here versus going to Copenhagen or saying that you wanted to jump to Berlin or Helsinki or somewhere else? Why here?
Not obvious. Our first aim was Copenhagen, but it's tricky to come as a Swede and do business in Denmark. It's not as easy. And we had a good opportunity together with our friends from our legacy who proposed that we should do something big together. So the timing was right and it feels good.
And not too daunting, of a market in a way, because, there are some established players. We don't have to mention them. But there are certainly, players in the mix who are even selling some of the same brands that you're bringing to it. And, there is sort of a bit of a north-south divide in Stockholm. You've chosen the north part of the city as well. So did you kind of divide up your territory like a fashion gang?
No, we haven't been in this business for so long, but now it's been 6 years. And what's best for you is to just focus on what you want to do and don't think about anyone else pretty much ever. Just...
And that doesn't end. And you find that even brands don't try to sort of protect existing clients?
Absolutely. We have discussions every single minute with the brands. But we don't want to, but we never ask exclusive or anything like that. We, of course, I care about the brands and want them to be in good places. But as long as we work with them, I'm happy.
I mean, Andrew and I were chatting because you went and toured the store earlier. It was funny because you were saying that there is this sort of, not workwear, but the sort of functionalist menswear fashion tribalism that you've sort of clocked around the world.
It's obviously a large collection of brands that these people buy into, but there's a kind of look and a kind of guy that you actually see now in Stockholm and you see in London and you see in New York. And it was interesting, we sat in your shop for 20 minutes and we just watched people come in and out. And it's not actually the kind of look you people probably associate with Sweden. It was a little bit more dressed, a little bit more kind of... a slight interest in the detail, great shirts, good jackets, but not kind of incredibly formal. But you realise that they are part of a bit of an international tribe as well as being this little urban group in Stockholm. And yeah. I wondered if you'd kind of seen that develop.
Absolutely. We call him the monocle guy, actually.
Are you serious?
Yes.
Or do you say this on all radio programs?
It's my first radio program, actually. So.
I want to go back to that. I mean, I guess I wouldn't say it goes back to our launch, but I mean, we've probably, maybe sort of 6 seasons into, the popularity of these brands, designers like, Daiki Suzuki. We've, of course, sort of seen, APC sort of was in London, they left London, they've come back again. And then, brands like Nanamika, and there's so many... I think so many companies that sort of, feed into that aesthetic. Do you think it's going to run for a while? I mean, I know you don't have a crystal ball as someone who's a retailer, but, do you see that suddenly this is going to take, a rather sharp turn and we're going to end up going somewhere else?
This is something we discuss very often, of course, because we work with many of those brands. And although we have a lot of brands and many different styles, this is a very strong look for us. But I think this style is here to stay much longer than other styles. Mm. I think many young men has kind of found themselves to be not too dressy. They have to iron their shirts and pants all the time. Not too fashion with tricky t-shirts, deep v-necks. It's easy.
Mm.
It's easy to be sharp, but still feel relaxed and not too dressed up.
I mean, it's surprising, isn't it, that, you know, we were talking, you know, at the start of the program about sort of, you know, powerful brands in this country, specifically sort of fashion, that oddly, you know, if you look around sort of Zara and H&M, and they actually haven't picked up on this. You know, they're kind of a little bit caught in deep V-neck land still. And of course, that's good news for you because it means people can't go and shop on price. But it almost strikes me that this is a little bit different as well. People are also really buying into the label because anyone can do a check shirt right now. Yeah. But what's interesting is I think people, they do want the quality, the detail. Was it made in Japan? Was it spun in America? That's also key, isn't it?
Definitely. And that's where the high street chains can't keep up because the customer values quality and craftsmanship a lot. So, and it's impossible for the high street chains to do that.
Mm. Just going back to your e-commerce model, you know, it's interesting that, you know, when you talk about sort of traditional bricks and mortar retail, you know, the major brands are always very careful. They don't want to sell to more than two or three shops in a given city. And how many streets apart are they? And did they buy those trousers? And if they bought them, then, you know, I want to make sure I get those sweaters. But of course, online, you know, gives you the opportunity to really open up to anyone. And you can pretty much, I guess, sell across the world, can't you? And I'm wondering if that's, do you think that brands are going to start locking down on that? Because, you know, we also see the rise of Net-a-Porter and they're launching a men's brand, as we know, etc. Do you think that the sort of wide open world of the web is actually going to become a bit more confined in terms of who you can sell to?
The web business for many clothing companies is kind of tricky. You have to have discussions all the time. The fashion or clothing industry moves quite, some move pretty fast online. Some is still locked down in like 80s thinking. Online for them is problem. They don't know who's going to see it, who's going to buy it, will anyone buy, will it be exposed on the right matter. The problem is they don't see online retailers as individuals. They don't go deeper to see how is that online shop, as they do with the bricks and mortars around the world.
Yeah. I mean, but before we went on, I mean, Elna, you were talking about, you know, we were talking about sort of the quality of baked goods between, you know, the middle of the country and southern Sweden. Do you think that there is, I almost sort of a certain attraction maybe for a company like Trevian because they're based in this place called Malmö. So it seems a little bit odd and quirky. And do you think that that's maybe part of the charm too?
Yes, there probably might be curiosity about that and in a positive way. But I think also I've noticed in Stockholm this new interest in organic and sustainable fashion and things that actually more and more people are prepared to pay a little bit more and actually buy something that you can wear for a long time and sort of feel a little bit bad now going to H&M and actually think, well, I'm not going to buy that 100 krona shirt. Instead, I'm going to buy, or five of those, I'm going to buy one good one. And maybe that's just good news for you.
It's very good news for us. And it's also a discussion we have. We don't have a environment kind of policy, but we try to get people to buy less clothes. Sounds a bit strange, but focus on the good ones, then you don't need to buy so many.
Yeah, I mean, that idea of sort of, you know, as you're saying, sort of, you know, grabbing an armful of shirts just because they're a good price, etc. Just going back to your point about that, you know, that men have sort of, you know, found their groove, and, you know, because I think we saw this pace that fashion was, you know, was moving incredibly fast, and sort of, you know, I'll throw it open to sort of to everybody. Do you think that's just sort of symptomatic, you know, Andrew, of the times that that maybe things did have to slow down? So Elna's saying that, yeah, there just is a consideration, and, you know, and part of it ties into, of course, what we're talking about, you know, in the issue as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. You see it with the high luxury brands in women's wear, you know, that things are a little bit more muted, a little bit more kind of toned down. And I think that across the market, that's what's happened, that people have gone back, you know, in every sector to craft, to heritage, to wanting to know the story behind things, to an increased understanding of, you know, who's making their clothes. But what's funny is that unlike in other downturns, there hasn't been this revival of very strict tailoring. Because, you know, I remember when it happened in the 80s, that people, they said they were scared about their jobs. There was a return to very formal tailoring and people were kind of dressing as though they had to kind of be going for a job interview every day. But that doesn't seem to have happened this time. It seems to be the opposite, actually, that people are actually wearing this kind of more workwear kind of look that seems to say, actually, I'm quite comfortable about who I am. I'm not going to show off. I'm a bit more toned down in the kind of looks I've got.
But But it's not sloppy either, though.
No, it's not sloppy at all, but it's just interesting how it tilts sometimes. Sometimes, you know, that when things are not so good in the economy, people feel compelled to look as though they're kind of dressed for a job interview every day.
Well, it's called workwear.
Yeah.
When actually it's sort of workwear if you maybe you're a tree surgeon.
Well, Andrew, isn't it interesting that also that Rob can travel as well? He can travel with barely any clothes. I mean, you're on the road for what, 3 days? He's got a monocle tote bag with, like, I don't even know, there's a pair of underpants in there.
I'm a phenomenally good packer. I'll have a pack off.
Exactly.
I also left some things there, which is probably quite important.
We're gonna be running out to ICA or to one of the grocery chains to get you some goodies.
I'll be swimming naked. I'm probably travelling back.
Yeah, absolutely. you certainly will be swimming naked. Hannes Hogeman of Trebien. The new shop is called Welcome. It's on Sibyllagatan here in Stockholm. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. We're back in a moment. You're back with The Monocle Weekly, where it's time to say goodbye, because it looks like the numbers on the clock are saying it's really sort of end of Sunday morning. So goodbye, Rob.
It's hockey o'clock.
It is hockey o'clock. I think I do think that the hockey team, I hear the sticks out in the hallway. Now we have to go.
None more frightening.
I hope it's been a good trip for you.
Yeah, I loved it.
The rattling of the birch leaves.
Love that.
Yes.
Rattling.
Absolutely. Andrew Tuck, good for you.
Yeah, I loved it. Love my buller. I am leaving a rather sticky desk, I'm afraid, in front of me.
I think it's going to be interesting sort of watching, though, what happens between, as we were saying earlier, you know, in a couple of weeks' time when Brand Finland sort of rolls out this new idea. I know they talk about it sort of being very cozy up here, but I don't know, it'll be curious to see how one responds to a newer sort of, you know, polished down Finland.
Yes, absolutely. And the Monocle Finland survey.
Absolutely. I love that she plugs everything she plugs.
I know,
Monocle
and
everything else. Well, that's all for this week's edition of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show was produced by Alex Mills, and our sound engineer was DR Boskani here at Sveriges Radio in Stockholm. If you have any thoughts or comments for today's show, then do drop us a note to weekly@monocle.com. And remember, you can catch up with us daily via our Monocle on our site. Next week, we'll be in Brussels opening up our own pop-up retail venture. But for now, from Stockholm, I'm Tyler Brulé.
I'm Robert Band.
I'm Andrew Tuck.
I'm Elon Anderson.
And that's all from Stockholm. Hej då!